The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Craig H.D. Armon presiding.
Morning, counsel. We'll call 4-23-0192, People of the State of Illinois versus Douglas Valentine. Could counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
My name is Brian Carroll from the State Appellate Defender's Office, representing the appellant, Douglas Valentine.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Could counsel for the appellee please state your name for the record?
Nicholas Atwood on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois.
Thank you, Mr. Atwood. Mr. Carroll, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This court should reverse the circuit court and remand Valentine's post-conviction petition for second stage proceedings because the petition, taken as true and liberally construed, made an arguable showing that Valentine was denied his right to the effective assistance of both trial and appellate counsel, or alternatively, because Valentine's post-conviction counsel failed to provide him with reasonable representation. So, first, trial counsel was arguably ineffective for failing to investigate and utilize impeachment evidence that would have undermined MB's credibility. Valentine informed counsel that during the period when the alleged sexual relationship between him and MB was supposedly taking place, MB had denied knowledge of him engaging in any inappropriate conduct when she was questioned as part of an investigation into rumors, which proved to be unfounded, that he had engaged in misconduct when part of a different water ski team. Although evidence of MB's denial would have undermined the credibility of her later accusations against Valentine, trial counsel failed to investigate the matter at all. Second, counsel also failed to use text messages that were tendered during discovery, showing that MB had engaged or had suggested to a friend that they use Valentine's stripper pole and reassured the friend that Valentine would not want to watch them while they used it. This evidence would also have undermined her MB's credibility because it is unlikely she would have made such a suggestion had her allegations against Valentine, including those involving her using his stripper pole, were true. So the failure to investigate and utilize impeachment evidence has been held to constitute ineffective assistance of counsel, that these allegations taken as true make an arguable showing that counsel's failure to use this evidence was objectively unreasonable.
So MB wasn't impeached with any other testimony?
What was that, Your Honor?
MB was not impeached by any other testimony. This is the only thing that would have impeached her credibility. And without it, then?
No, Your Honor. She was impeached a number of times with other evidence, but this would have been, building up the mountain of impeaching evidence was critical to this defense because this was a closely balanced he said, she said case. So as much impeaching evidence, particularly a denial of any of her
calling it closely balanced doesn't make it so.
Excuse me?
Calling it closely balanced doesn't make it so.
Well, this was a he said, she said case. There was no physical evidence or any objective evidence proving or collaborating MB's allegations. It was purely her word against his.
Let's go back to your first claim. What's the first claim that you say wasn't properly raised?
That would be the MB's denial when she was asked in the summer of 2008, I believe, whether or not she was aware of any misconduct or inappropriate behavior on Valentine's part, and she denied that.
Let's say the state sought to introduce evidence through the victim that she had heard rumors that the defendant had previously engaged in inappropriate behavior with minors. Do you think that would have been objected to?
I mean, if this the state just brought it up, yes, I think that would that would have been.
So you're saying, though, that that wouldn't have been something that might actually be somewhat prejudicial to the defendant and probably was a good trial tactic not to raise.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Well, so you think a jury would have considered the fact that there's other rumors of other minor victims out there, and just because this girl says she doesn't know about that, that's not going to somehow affect their decision-making in this case?
Well, it was not just evidence of rumors. It was evidence of that rumors had been proven to be untrue.
You don't get to bring that out. That wouldn't have come out either way.
Well,
how are you going to establish that?
Well, let me backtrack, Your Honor. I think if counsel had properly investigated these matters, then if the state tried to bring it up, these rumors, I think he probably would not have objected because he would necessarily would have to front at least some information that the rumors existed in order to bring up this impeachment evidence. And whether or not the evidence of the rumors would, the any prejudicial effect they might have would outweigh any the probative value of entering evidence of her denial, counsel could not make that determination without first investigating the evidence to see exactly what was out there. And without that, he was not able to make that balancing. So without conducting a reasonable investigation into the matter, his failure to raise it cannot be assumed to have been sound trial strategy. And the record is silent as to why counsel didn't bring it up. As far as this record's concerned,
because in most instances, I can't think of too many competent criminal defense lawyers who want to bring up the fact that their client is rumored to have engaged in sexual episodes with other minors uncharged and not otherwise being tested in court.
Well, again, Your Honor, we don't know exactly everything about what evidence was out there. And this is not just evidence of rumors. It's evidence of rumors that were proven to be untrue and was accompanied by a denial from the—
How are you going to present evidence that they're proven to be untrue?
How does that matter? Because it—
No, how can you present? What possible evidence can you present to establish that these rumors are quote, proven to be untrue?
Well, they would be able to bring in the context of the thing of the evidence. There would be the evidence of the investigation, and the final result of the investigation was concluded.
You're talking about a whole mini trial on uncharged, unproven conduct that you want to parade in front of a jury who's going to be listening to a minor victim talking about sexual episodes with this defendant.
Not at all, Your Honor. None of the details of the rumors have to come in at all.
Well, that makes it even worse. With all due respect, counsel, and I know sometimes people say that and don't really mean it. Have you prosecuted or defended any criminal sexual assault cases in front of a jury?
Okay, Your Honor, in this case,
it's a simple question because it has to do with a level of experience that I'm just asking you about first before I ask the next question.
Because
I'm not familiar with you and you're not familiar with me, so okay, need to ask.
I have not tried any sort of sexual offense case on the trial level. No, I have not.
Here's the reason I ask. Because the dynamics of these cases are such that I can't envision after 25 years of criminal trial experience as a prosecutor and defense attorney, 17 years on the trial bench, I can't envision any defense attorney wanting to purposely present evidence to a jury that my client has been rumored to be involved with other minors in other instances under any circumstances whatsoever. You know, as an intellectual exercise, this may sound interesting, but from the realities of the situation, I can't envision any criminal defense lawyer wanting to bring in more evidence that would at least start jurors thinking, well, wait a minute, there's been other rumors about this guy? This guy's been involved with other minors? Well, they're saying that they were unproven. Well, how do we know that they're unproven? Does it just mean that it didn't get charged? Does that mean that somebody just refused to testify? I really can't. When I read this argument, I thought to myself, I can't envision any competent criminal defense lawyer actually wanting to bring this out. The fact that the defendant has decided that for some reason, he thinks this would be to his benefit, in my opinion, defies all reasonable logic in criminal defense of child sexual assault cases and would be the last thing you would want presented. If the state tried to bring this out, you would have been screaming bloody murder. You can't bring this out on my client. You can't be having the jury hear about possible rumors of stories of investigations of other allegations with other minors that are uncharged, unproven. So I'm really kind of wondering what makes you think this is a good argument?
Rihanna, all I can say is in this case, counsel didn't investigate the matter. We don't know exactly the full details of her denial. So as I said, based on this record and what we know that counsel did not investigate the matter. So he couldn't, we still maintain he couldn't have made the strategic decision based on a lack of investigation. But moving on, this is not the thing we have. Counsel also failed to investigate the text messages that would be very unlikely that MB would have made suggestions of using Valentine's stripper pole if her allegations against him were true.
Why would that be unlikely?
Why would it be unlikely that if she felt that he was a sexual predator or someone who was a threat in some ways,
nobody says that child victims of sexual assault who are being victimized by persons of trust or some level of closeness see them as sexual predators or that they feel threatened.
Well, that's for the jury to decide, and they weren't given that opportunity in this case because counsel failed to introduce this evidence. Again, Valentine doesn't have to prove that this evidence absolutely would have changed the outcome of the trial. Just as that it's arguable that this could have influenced the jury's determination of credibility, and that it was arguable that it was improper for counsel to fail to use it. And again, this is a first stage post-conviction case, so he doesn't have to prove everything up at this point, because he has to make an arguable case. And this is evidence that arguably could have changed the juror's mind. And therefore, it's arguable that counsel was ineffective for failing to introduce it. Counsel was also arguably ineffective for failing to file a pretrial motion to dismiss the counts charging criminal sexual assault for failing to comply with Section 111-3 of the Criminal Code of Criminal Procedure for not adequately setting forth the nature of the offense, and appellate counsel was arguably ineffective for not raising this issue on direct appeal. So, the criminal sexual assault counts asserted that Valentine held a position of trust, authority, and supervision in relation to MB, but did not allege any facts indicating that he in fact held such a position. And under the holding of People v. Sparks, merely parroting the statutory language was not sufficient to comply with Section 111-3, and therefore the failure to allege facts specifying the particular nature of Valentine's relationship with respect to MB was fatal to the indictment. And therefore, it's at least arguable that counsel should have recognized the flaw in the indictment and moved to dismiss the counts.
Does this even prejudice the defendant at all when his defense in this case was these sex acts didn't even happen? So whether he's in a position of authority or supervision, does that even matter when he denies that it happened at all?
Well, Your Honor, this doesn't have anything. This issue has nothing to do with evidence that's actually introduced at trial. It's had counsel raised this issue and it was denied, nothing would have prevented him from raising the same, the defense that he did at trial. And I mean, it doesn't make any sense to forego an opportunity to have those counts wiped out prior to trial and instead just rolling the dice and hoping that the trial goes your way. So yes, he was prejudiced by this. Had he filed the motion would have been granted under the holding in Sparks. And on the record we have, it's arguable that the state wouldn't have adequately amended the indictment, where the state never articulated how it believed Valentine held the position of trust, authority, or supervision over MB, other than there's pointing out that he was an adult and she was a minor. However, the ages of the defendant and the complaint are a separate statutory element of the offense than the trust, authority, or supervision element. Therefore, it requires something more, and the state never articulated that something more below. So it's at least arguable that those counts would have been dismissed had trial counsel raised that at or had filed a pretrial motion to dismiss those counts. And final ineffective assistance claim, that appellate counsel was arguably ineffective for failing to argue that the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Valentine held a position of trust and authority or supervision in relation to MB. Valentine was not MB's coach or babysitter. He did not financially support her in any way. And most importantly, the record shows that MB viewed him as just a friend, not any sort of authority figure. Now, the reasoning behind the statute is that minors tend to obey those they view as being in positions of trust, authority, or supervision, and therefore the minors would be more vulnerable to those people. It therefore follows that if the complainant did not view the defendant as holding a position of trust, authority, or supervision over her, then the circumstances in which for which the statute was intended to apply don't exist. And that's what we have in this case. MB never described.
How do you recognize or reconcile what you just said with the defendant's testimony that he was trying to be a big brother, an uncle, a protector? He sometimes treated her as a niece and sometimes kind of like a daughter, and then also testified that he was her chaperone on some of these outings where the alleged sex abuse took place.
Well, it's Valentine's position that it is and B's view of him that's important, because if she doesn't view him as some sort of authority figure, then the vulnerability and the danger that the statute was intended to protect against isn't there. So it doesn't matter what her parents or what Ballantyne thought, it's what MB thought. And this record shows that she just treated him like a friend. She never described him as anything other than a friend. Their text conversations demonstrated that they interacted more like two teenagers.
So in sexual assault cases involving a position of trust or supervision, the victim's perspective alone makes that determination?
I believe in there's no case specifically stating that, but I believe that is what follows from the reasoning behind the statute. And you know, people be sector.
So in reality, if a person under no other circumstance would be construed as being in a position of trust, supervision, or authority, if the victim sees it that way, then that's enough.
Well, no, I think if the person held an official position, like a coach, a teacher, something like that.
Because your point was it's the victim's state of mind. So let's discount what their actual position is. In fact, let's assume for a minute that they do not fall under any of those other criteria. If the victim perceives them as a person of that position, then that's enough. That's what your argument is.
Actually, yeah. Yes, Your Honor. It's the victim's state of mind that's important. The victim.
If that's your logic, then it's irrelevant as to whether there's any further description of the position of trust, supervision, or authority in the charge, because it's irrelevant. You've just made it irrelevant by indicating that it's the victim's state of mind, has nothing to do with what the state charges or how they plead it, correct?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Wait a minute, you can't have it both ways. It has to be charged, and it has to be laid out specifically what that position is. But then on the other hand, you've now argued, no, it doesn't matter what the reality of the position is, it's what the victim's state of mind is. Those are not consistent.
I believe they are consistent, Your Honor. Because the indictment is not, again, it's not setting forth all the evidence at trial. So if the state's theory is that the defendant fits one of these positions because they're the complainant's coach, then that would satisfy section 111-3. However, if at trial the evidence came out that the victim did not view their actual relationship between the victim and the defendant did not fit a position of trust, authority, or supervision, then I believe there would be grounds for an acquittal.
Okay. Well, I took you past your time, and I apologize. You will be given an opportunity to respond on rebuttal. Mr. Atwood.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Nicholas Atwood, and I represent the people of the state of Illinois. The trial court properly dismissed defendant's petition at the first stage because defendant raised no issues that even stated the gist of a constitutional claim. I'd like to begin by addressing the most recent issue that Your Honors discussed with defense counsel, and that's the issue of whether the indictment was fatally flawed for failing to state the specific basis for how defendant was in a position of trust, supervisory, or authority with the victim. The first problem with defendant's argument is that his reliance on Sparks for the proposition that if the defense counsel was ineffective for failing to file a motion to dismiss because the Sparks court granted that motion, but procedurally, Sparks is different than the case we have before us. First of all, Sparks was a state appeal. So the state filed an interlocutory appeal challenging the dismissal of that indictment by the trial court. The trial court or the appellate court affirmed the dismissal, but that wouldn't have prevented the state from reindicting the same charges with a specific allegation related to how the defendant was in that particular position. That's exactly what was noted in the Frazier case. So if we work backwards and we imagine a scenario where defense counsel filed for a motion of a bill of particulars or filed for a motion to dismiss, if the court had granted it, the state would have been able to easily amend the indictment because defendant was under no surprise, and they could have done so all the way up to the eve of trial, and it doesn't allege a new offense, it simply amends an existing offense. So by law, the state maintained the ability to do that. The premise of defendant's argument was that the state failed to allege or could not have alleged how that particular requirement of those elements would have been satisfied based on a couple of statements the state made in post-trial motions or perhaps in closing argument. But that's not how we review these claims on a post-conviction petition. The trial court can dismiss on any basis that's in the original record. And as your honors have noted, defense counsel's entire strategy was that this defendant was a good guy. He had a close familial relationship. He was a chaperone, an uncle, a brother. He portrayed himself as this wonderful person who was a great friend and mentor to this particular victim and practically a member of their family. So the record is replete with numerous examples of how this would have been satisfied by the state. And so given the procedural nature of this being post-conviction, this court can consider any one of those bases as a factor that establishes those elements of the indictment. And that same evidence goes towards proving the element, the reasonable doubt. The state proved those elements beyond a reasonable doubt. So appellate counsel wasn't ineffective for raising that particular issue. And defendant has argued or promoted an extremely narrow view of People v. Reynolds when he contends that you have to look at this through the eyes of the victim. The victim is a 14-year-old child. She is vulnerable to the influence of these people in positions of trust and authority precisely because she's so young. So to place the burden on a child victim to be able to recognize the nature of the defendant's involvement with her and how that risks increasing her likelihood of being victimized is completely illogical. And it would turn the whole purpose of the law upside down if we required victims to be able to identify these threats. That's why these statutes exist. And importantly, that's Reynolds didn't even say it has to be taken from the position of the victim. It's clear what the evidence established. The parents believed he was in that position. Defendant believed he was in that position. The only person who didn't necessarily testify to that was the victim. And that's because the victim was engaged in this inappropriate relationship with the defendant, and she was clearly unable to differentiate the risk that she was actually under. The law is designed for her protection, not for her to act as an agent of the law, as defendant requests. With regard to the text messages—
Well, it's even more potentially prejudicial to the defendant if it's the state of mind of the victim that establishes the element of the offense. In other words, the aggravating factor is what the victim thinks. So it wouldn't matter whether the person really didn't occupy one of those positions otherwise identified as a position of authority, trust, or supervision. As long as she believes it, according to counsel, that's enough.
Correct. I think it certainly would lower the burden of proof. The state would be required if all a victim had to do was subjectively testify to a defendant's status, whether there was any evidence to support that or not outside of the victim's own testimony. Another issue I wanted to address was just with regard to the text messages, specifically the text message involving the stripper pole. I think the trial court correctly found that, you know, first of all, this basically lacks relevancy. I don't believe there's any possibility based off the record that exists that there's a arguable, reasonable probability of a different result if that gets admitted. I think your honors noted that there was significant evidence that would already went to the issue of credibility with the victim. But importantly, the court said this lacks relevance and it's likely hearsay and that the court wouldn't have admitted it in the first place. And it's important to note here, the victim even testified that she had joked with her friends about being strippers. In it was either in the testimony or in some of the text messages, she and her friends would joke about this. Defendant is asking the court to think that the jury would take literally the victim's text message to this third party friend of hers that she would be willing to go over to the defendant's house and that he wouldn't be willing or he wouldn't be threatening to them when, you know, she's been hiding this abuse the entire time. So, of course, he's not going to be frank in dealing with this friend of hers. She's not going to joke, oh, we better not go there. We'll probably get, you know, assaulted in some way. That there's no way the jury would find this piece of evidence to be the cherry on top that would completely tip the scale of credibility. So I think the trial court made that finding on its own and found that even if this was admitted, there really wouldn't be a change in the result. One of the other primary issues I also wanted to discuss was the Rule 3.14 limiting instruction. And the defendant has argued that his counsel was ineffective for not providing the for allowing to be admitted an alternative instruction under 3.14 that removed the limiting language from that jury instruction. But defendant's argument on this is sort of backwards logically, and that's because defendant would not want to highlight this evidence for some limited purpose. It was the defendant's contention throughout that this never happened. And so this was actually a bit of a coup for defense counsel to get this modified instruction because it allowed the jury to consider it for any purpose, which is it didn't happen at all. If it's limited to motive, intent, or, you know, something of that nature that's under 3.14, it implicitly agrees that that conduct occurred. This is not logical in the context of defendant's trial strategy. And so this was a beneficial modification of that instruction because it allowed the jury to consider it for the fact that it did not happen. If the limiting language was included, they could have only considered it for those limited reasons that are stated in the instruction. And so this was a good trial strategy employed by defense counsel to allow them to just completely deny that that event ever occurred. And there are numerous cases that talk about the risk of using that limiting language because you're hemming in the jury's ability to consider that particular evidence. And another issue that I wanted to briefly discuss was just the implication of People v. Tate on this case. That's the Illinois Supreme Court case that stated that the trial court, usually you can't consider like strategy in the context of a first stage post-conviction petition. But what Tate specifically said is that the trial court is not required to ignore the record that exists. And in this case, we had a trial court that issued, frankly, an extremely thoughtful written ruling dealing with the issues raised in this petition. And the trial court who also presided, or the post-conviction court who also presided over the trial, referred to the fact that this was good trial strategy and that it was evident from the record. And so what Tate specifically said is a claim based on what would have been done may depend on proof of matters outside the record. That's typically why we don't look at strategy, because a lot of the times you'll need an evidentiary hearing to hear why counsel did something. But from this record, it is obvious as to why counsel made the certain strategic decisions that are being complained of now on appeal, because, you know, with regard to the position of trust and supervision, that was the basis of their strategy to make the defendant look like a good guy. And for the same reasons of not wanting to limit the evidence related to the text messages. Do your honors have any other questions on the remaining issues? If not, the people would stand on their brief.
I have a question.
Yes.
Mr. Carroll said that because this is a he said, she said case, it's closely balanced. My question to you is, a he said, she said case necessarily closely balanced under case law?
This is an interesting question. I've been grappling with this issue in several cases over the last few months, and I didn't raise the particular argument in this case, but under People v. Sebi, which is the Illinois Supreme Court case that discusses this, you know, is a he said, she said presumptively closely balanced. There is language that I can't quote to you directly, but I can in supplemental briefing if you'd like, that to me indicates it is not presumptively closely balanced because as a condition precedent, both parties must be credible. It doesn't matter if I say the sky is blue and someone else says the sky is pink and that's what the determination was based off of. That doesn't mean the sky is pink. That's not a credible bit of evidence. So how can it be closely balanced simply because it's one person's testimony against another? And so I believe the appropriate way to analyze that issue is, first, are both parties credible on the particular issue? If yes, then that goes towards, is this evidence closely balanced? But I do not believe or agree that evidence, just because it is a he said, she said, testimonial in nature, that it is presumptively closely balanced, to answer your question.
Well, I appreciate that, but there's not a case that actually says what you just articulated. Is that
you? It's an interpretation of a direct line in SEBI, and I can't quote it, but SEBI essentially said that they had determined that both were credible, and then stated that evidence is closely balanced. But the fact that they first determined that both were credible indicates there should be an assessment of credibility before determining closely balanced. I do not know if one of the previous cases I have made that argument in has issued a ruling on that. I'm not 100% sure. I might have to go back to People v. Luna. That's another Fourth District case that I argued maybe 5 months ago or 4 months ago. I did raise it in that case.
Well, and would I be accurate if I said that you also argued in your brief that there is evidence to suggest that this is not actually simply a he said, she said case?
That's correct. There is evidence that, you know, much of the defendant's testimony did corroborate, you know, places, times. The only thing at issue was the actual abuse itself. He wasn't denying that he was alone with her. He wasn't denying that she was in his house or that she had seen the stripper pole. Like, all it boiled down to the actual instances of the physical abuse being the disputed element.
Thank you, Justice DeArmond. Those are the only questions that I had.
All right. I see no other questions. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Carroll, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be quick. In terms of the last question about SEBI, I believe there is a line in SEBI about that, like, neither side's testimony was, like, fantastical or something like that. But in this case, we don't have, you know, Valentine's testimony was not fantastical. He was not claiming that the sky was pink or brown. So the distinction counsel's trying to make between not all he said, she said cases are closely balanced just doesn't exist here.
Well, Mr. Carroll, wasn't it also her mother said, her father said, and text messages indicated a disturbing length and particularity of conversations that they had between themselves over time?
Well,
so it's not just he said, she said. Her mother overheard him talking to the daughter and saying something about, what the F, I really want to do to buy that dress. It was short, and when you danced, I'm sure everyone can see your hoo-ha.
Yes,
and that they were listening to a rather disturbing conversation that was being held. And then you've got a significant number of text messages, which, although not descriptive of sexual events, definitely corroborate what the victim is saying has happened or is happening at times, circumstances, and the nature of the relationship seems disturbing to the parents. That's all evidence that's outside of a he said, she said, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's all evidence of a friendship, that they have a friendship similarly.
That's true. You know, you can put the spin on it that you want. The prosecutor will put the spin on it that he wants. My point is, it is other evidence beyond just him saying one thing and she saying another.
I mean, it's evidence that they have a friendship, but it's not evidence that suggesting the assault she alleged happened actually took place.
If you don't want to answer the question, that's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I have to disagree with you. I believe I did answer the question.
I understand. It is extrinsic. It is additional evidence, period. Regardless of how you spin the evidence, it is additional evidence beyond simply his saying he didn't and she saying he did.
Yeah, I agree. It's additional evidence, but I don't think it weighs in favor of either side.
Okay, go ahead.
Then I'll just address the unreasonable assistance of post-conviction claim with the jury instruction. Counsel said it was sort of a windfall for defense counsel not to have a limiting instruction given. I mean, there's plenty of cases in that the failure to seek a limiting instruction when other crime evidence is introduced is bad because it allows the jury to consider what otherwise would not be propensity evidence as propensity evidence. And that's what happened here. And it's not a case where counsel avoided the jury being, you know, the other crimes evidence being highlighted to the jury. They were given an instruction that specifically told the jury that, hey, other crimes evidence was introduced, yet it didn't give any limiting testimony or limiting instruction to the jury. So this windfall just didn't happen. And again, it's counsel's wanting to not highlight this stripper pole incident just didn't, his strategy didn't work. It wasn't sound because the jury was, the other crimes evidence was highlighted through this, the modified version of 3.14. It would have been, you know, it would have been better if no instruction was given at all than what counsel did. Otherwise, unless your honors have any other questions, I'll rest and just again ask that this court remand for second stage proceedings. Thank you.
All right. I see no other questions. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. The court stands in recess.